Hi, everyone. Welcome to this week's W3C CCG meeting. Today, we are very excited to have Manu and Dave from Digital Bazaar to lead a discussion on DC Bitstring status list. I saw that in the past few hours, people already have questions, so this will be a very exciting conversation. Before we start, I just want to go over some agenda items. First of all, a quick reminder on the code of ethics and professional conduct. Just want to make sure that everyone remain respectful to each other. I think we have been doing that for the last 2 years, but it doesn't hurt to have a quick reminder at the beginning of each meeting. A quick intellectual property note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributions to any CCG work items must be member of the CCG with full IPR agreements signed. If you have any questions in regards to that or any troubles creating the W3C account, feel free to just reach out to any of the co-chairs. A quick call note, these meetings are being automatically recorded and transcribed. We try to publish it within the next few days. Now, if you saw some mistakes on the transcriptions and needs corrections, just let us know. We use GT chat to cue the speakers during the call. You can type in Q plus in the comments to put yourself in the queue, or Q minus to remove. All right. I think it's time for the introductions and reintroductions. So if you're new to the community or you haven't been active and want to re-engage with the community, feel free to just unmute and introduce yourself. I see some unfamiliar faces, so feel free to just unmute. It's all right. We're a very friendly community. All right. Next, announcements and reminders. Any announcements or reminders? Manu, please.
Yeah, just some status updates on how the standardization work is going in the Verifiable Credential Working Group at the World Wide Web Consortium. We've now moved the Verifiable Credentials 2.0 specification into the candidate recommendation phase. That's the phase right before you propose it for an official vote for it to become a global standard. So at this point, VC Data Model 2.0, Data Integrity, ECDSA, EDDSA are all in the candidate recommendation phase. In the next month, we are expecting VC Hosey Cozy and Bitstring Status List, the thing we're talking about today, to go into candidate recommendation, and then shortly thereafter for BBS to go into candidate recommendation. Once that happens, all of the documents that the group has been working on will be in the candidate recommendation phase. People are implementing now. There are plenty of, there are actually a large, quite a good sizable number of implementers across the board. I think we have about 15 companies implementing right now. 11 of them are integrated with the test suites. The test suites continue to be updated. So if you're an implementer, now is a good time to start implementing. As I think folks know, we have started office hours for implementers that are held like every other week. I don't think Benjamin's here today, but Benjamin has been heading that up. So if you've got any questions, concerns with implementing against the Verifiable Credential 2.0 stuff, there are now office hours that you can show up to and ask your questions there. So the good news there is that, you know, we've got many things moving into the candidate recommendation phase, and we have active test suites and implementers implementing. The not so great news is we're running out of time for our charter. Our charter ends in June. There is an expectation that we'll get a charter extension, primarily because we've demonstrated that we're making really good progress across the board. That's it for me.
Thank you, Manu. And by the way, if you're curious about what's new on the Verified Credentials data model version 2. We actually invited Manu back as well as Brent to talk about what's new next week. All right, any other announcements or reminders? Last call for announcements or reminders. Kalia, please.
Sure. So we've got Internet Identity Workshop number 38 coming up in April 16 to 18, the Digital Identity Unconference Europe happening in Zurich in the third week of June. I believe it's the 18th to the 20th. And then we've got DID Unconference Africa happening in Cape Town the third week of September. And we're currently deciding on dates for our Asian event in Thailand in early 2025 between the second and the third week of January. So if anybody has any date conflicts they want us to avoid, let us know. I'm proactively reaching out to folks in the region to understand what our key sort of themes and sort of key themes and potential discussion topics will be. So if you have thoughts on that, let me know. And yeah, that's from updates from IAW land.
Thank you, Kalia. Seems like we have quite a bit of events coming up. All right, any other last announcements or reminders? Any updates on the work items? By the way, so Will, one of our co-chairs, is heading the initiative to clean up and actually extend the CCG roadmap. And we will have more news and more announcements to make sometime in April. So we're scheduling sometime in April to kind of present that roadmap. And if you have any feedback or comments in regards to the CCG roadmap or in regards to what kind of work items we should be taking on or what we should be working on, feel free to reach out to any of the co-chairs. But Will is actually taking the lead on that. So big shout outs to him. All right, last calls for announcements, work items, introductions. Great, let's get to the main agenda. So again, we're very excited to have Manu and Dave here to lead a discussion on VC Bitstream status list. This is probably the very first time in the last year where the presenter actually shared with me the presentation in advance. So I want to give a quick shout out to them. They're quite prepared. and a quick note, Bitstream status list is a way to publish status information like suspensions or revocations of the VC. So I'll let them kind of explain, dive into it further, as well as answering questions that's in the emails. Manu, the stage is yours. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks, Harrison. And thanks for the invite to present. Let me go ahead and share my screen, make sure folks can see this. Can folks see that?
Yes.
Okay. And I was able to finally extract the W3C Credentials Community Group banner so that we can put it on slide deck. So there's a community resource here. You can copy and paste this now if we want to put these on CCG slide decks. It's a very small thing. And anyway, okay, so today we're going to talk a bit about Bitstring status list. Bitstring status list is one of the status list technologies, or really the only status list technology that is being standardized in the Verifiable Credential Working Group right now. Today, I think we'll be covering, like, you know, what does it do? You know, why did we build it? What kind of privacy aims did we have when we were building it? We'll look into a bit in how it works, like what makes it tick. And then we'll have a little bit of discussion, like, you know, Bitstring status list is not the end all be all status list mechanism for VCs. It achieves some good privacy goals, but like we can do better. And so there's some talk about what the next version might end up looking like. But that's what we're going to cover today. Feel free to jump in anytime, raise your hand, Q+. We can do questions as we go. I don't think this is a very long presentation. All right. So let's take a quick look at what this is. So verifiable credentials have a credential status field, and that lets you publish things that you might want to update after the holder gets the credential, meaning like after a holder receives a verifiable credential, you might want to do things to that credential, like revoke it or suspend it or a variety of other kind of status flipping things. We wanted the mechanism, the Bitstring status list mechanism, to be privacy preserving by default. Some of the previous ways of doing status lists required the holder of the digital credential or whoever was verifying it to do what's called phoning home. So they would go out and try and ask the issuer, like, hey, is this credential still valid? And that tells the issuer that, you know, you, the holder, were using your credential with the verifier, and they get full transparency, like they get to see you using the credential. So think about you using a driver's license to get into a bar. You know, if you phone home to the issuer of the driver's license, then that government agency knows that you're going into bars and when you're going into bars and things of that nature. So that's what we mean by privacy preserving. We wanted to stop that from happening. The other thing was we wanted it to be space efficient, because verifiable credentials, could have like, thousands of different types. Sorry. You could have millions of credentials issued. Having a status list having like a status be big per credential would be like, you know, a small value, like, you know, 1 byte or 3 bytes or 10 bytes multiplied by millions to tens of millions to billions. So that wouldn't be a good thing. Okay. So, that's what we mean by space efficient. We wanted to make sure that the status, list, even with millions to tens of millions to billions, stayed, space efficient. And we wanted to make sure that we covered things like suspension and revocation. Okay. So some of the design goals here was we wanted to, provide status information for long-lived credentials. That was like one of the design goals, but we wanted to do it in a way that didn't like instantaneously violate an individual's privacy. So we had some privacy goals that we wanted to design for, that would protect the individual, primarily from being tracked by the issuer. And we wanted to make it like space efficient, and easy to implement. The specification is published here at this link at the bottom. It is a W3C standards track, global standards track specification. We are almost at the candidate recommendation phase, which basically means like we're pretty much done with the design. We think we're done with the design. We want people to implement it. We want them to give us their feedback. In reality, this thing's being rolled out into production environments very soon now, within like the next couple of weeks to months. So this thing is, you know, very real and is on track to be a global standard. Okay, that's the high level. Let's look a little bit at the privacy considerations, the things that we wanted to like design for with Bitstring status list. This diagram on the right comes from the VC data model. specification. It kind of shows you the ecosystem, like the, you know, the issuer, holder, verifier, registry ecosystem, and then a number of actions that you can take while you're in the ecosystem and what that action, you know, who communicates during that action. So the action we're looking at right here is this check status, might not preserve privacy, you know, repeatable thing highlighted in red at the center of the diagram here. This is when a verifier receives a digital credential from a holder and then they go to check the status, from the status list published by the issuer. So a couple of like high level requirements here was that the issuer, when the verifier contacted the issuer, and this is a form of like phoning home, right? Bad phoning home is when the issuer is when the verifier contacts the issuer and says, this is exactly who I want to know about. Better, like more privacy preserving is when the verifier contacts the issuer and says, I need a list of, you know, statuses from you. And the list is fairly large, like 100,000 or whatever. So what we wanted was we wanted to make sure that the issuer couldn't guess who the subject is based on the verifier asking. So there has to be some kind of group privacy at play there. The other design goal that we had is like we wanted to eliminate this phone home, you know, the we wanted to eliminate the verifier contacting the issuer at all, like completely. Like so the design had to enable that to happen. In fact, with Bitstring status list, the holder can provide the verifiable credential, and in parallel, they can provide the status list, the current status list, to the verifier so that the verifier never has to contact the issuer. Now, whether or not that's going to play out in practice is still, like, to be determined. But in theory, if the holder, you know, contacts the verifier and goes, here's my electrician's license, and here is a proof that this thing has not been revoked as of today, the verifier can look at both of those verifiable credentials and go, yep, that checks out, without having to talk to the issuer at all. So the second bullet point here is about making sure that the holder and the verifier can have an interaction where the verifier doesn't actually need to contact the issuer at all. That's, you know, privacy preserving, more privacy preserving. And finally, let's stop there. Will, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wondered, how does the verifier know that the information the holder is presenting is like live and current?
There is a valid from and valid until date on the status list credential. That gives them some idea of like when it was issued. So for example, like if I hand you, I give you my, I don't have an electrician's license, but I give you my electrician's license and I give you, the status list associated with it. Those are two verifiable credentials. Mm-hmm. And the only thing that you need to get from the issuer is like their DID document and their keys. And you can verify that both of those, you know, are valid. They were issued today. And if your use case is such that you're like, well, this is valid as of today, or it's valid as of like 3 days ago, that's good enough for my use case, then you don't need to call back to the issuer to get the status list. Did that make sense?
Yep. So the holder, in a way, would be the person who's asking the issuer for a live credential of the status list.
Yes, exactly right. Yep.
Cool.
Yeah. And the holder would use the same mechanism that the verifier would. And, you know, and it could be like the holder is actually using like some kind of, you know, a cloud wallet where the cloud wallet is the thing that actually makes the request. So the issuer doesn't even know which holder, you know, is making the request. And the cloud wallet provider could cache that information so that it only happens like once a day. Like there are all kinds of, things that a good actor in the system could do to further protect the individual's privacy when doing status list checking. All right. Did that cover it, Will?
Yeah, great.
Okay, great. Great question. Okay, the third bullet point here. is that we also wanted to use existing infrastructure to increase privacy. So things like content distribution networks, things like HTTP caching, things like oblivious HTTP, all of these technologies are already deployed out there. They exist in the world, except for like oblivious HTTP. That's still being like rolled out, but CDNs exist and caching exists, and we can use those technologies to make it so that even when it looks like you're going back and contacting the issuer, you're actually just hitting a CDN or you're hitting a local cache of some kind. And the reason we wanted to use CDNs and caches is so that when the issuer, you know, if the issuer were to look at their like HTTP logs to see like who got which status list and when, there's actually not a tremendous amount of traffic there. Meaning like if this is deployed correctly, again, with an honest issuer, the issuer would see maybe like a handful of hits on the status list a day. And that's kind of it. Okay, so those were kind of the protecting against tracking by the issuer use cases that we're looking at. I'm reading Colin's question in chat. Give me a second. So how does this impact the issuer's ability to see if the credential was used? They can't see it. That's kind of the whole point, right? We did not, there are legitimate use cases where it would be good for the issuer to know when the individual is using the credential, but there are far more, use cases where that we're not designing for that. Like, you know, if you want to have some kind of callback mechanism, that is out of scope. We don't want to enable that by default. We want to disable that by default and then, only enable it maybe on a case by case basis. But even then you're on pretty thin ice from a privacy standpoint. Did that answer your question, Colin?
There are some use cases where it might actually be beneficial, right, from economic impact, and but yeah, those are case by case, and those would be conversations if somebody's actually implementing VCs in earnest and they're looking at doing some of that, they would want to bake that in. But I think, yeah, totally understand what the point is here, is you don't want to enable that by default. So thanks.
Yeah. I mean, it's an uphill argument trying to convince, I think, at least a privacy community, us included, that you want to enable phone home in any way. I mean, full stop, right? I mean, I think that the reason a lot of us are working on these technologies is to prevent the sort of pervasive tracking that happens today. But as you said, it is important to measure how these things are being used in the wild. But there may be better ways of doing that rather than through the technology, through the core technology. Better ways meaning like you need to get consent from your community. You need to be very clear that, you know, you are aggregating, you know, usage. If an issuer is going to collude with a verifier, they need to be very transparent about that, because if they're not, it will come back in a very negative way on them. Primarily through like privacy regulation, California Consumer Privacy Act, GDPR, Virginia Privacy Act, Colorado Privacy Act, all that kind of stuff. You got to be careful when you do those kinds of things these days. Okay. So those are kind of the protect against tracking by the issuer concerns that we had. We also wanted to protect against statistical analysis. I also want people to pay close attention here. We tried really hard to protect against tracking by an issuer, issuer-based correlation. Verifier-based correlation, when two verifiers get together and try to collude to track you, is a much more difficult problem. It is missing from here because it's such a difficult one to address. We can talk about it a bit later, but I wanted to be transparent about, you know, the things that we felt we could address and the things that we felt like we couldn't easily address. Okay. Protecting against statistical analysis. So, we wanted to make sure that, you know, if we were providing something for, group privacy, we're using the word group privacy now instead of herd privacy. We wanted to make sure that that group privacy actually meant something, meaning that if someone were to watch the status list as it changed throughout time, would they be able to glean any kind of information from it? Would they be able to, understand like who a subset of the population was or where you were in that subset of the population or how that group interact, you know, works in the real world. So, the way you do that is you watch the list and then you run statistical analysis, on it. So for example, if you had a list, let's say you had a status list that's 100,000 items, at large. We have minimum sizes and 100,000. You don't go smaller than 100,000. The spec, insists that you do not. So if you started, allocating indexes linearly where the first VC gets the first index, you know, gets the first, bit, the second VC gets the second bit, the third VC gets the third bit, and so on and so forth. And you were to just like bulk, revoke a set of credentials, or you were to kind of like revoke certain credentials, in the set. Someone looking at the giant list, the giant array of bits would notice that like bits above 25,000 are just quiet. They're always zero. Right? They never change. And that would allow statistically, you would basically say, oh, this group is less than 25,000 individuals, right? And you could watch for patterns in that where like, oh, the front of the list has a lot more revocations than the back of the list. And over time, it looks like these credentials are being revoked, you know, 6 months after they're being issued. And if you know the type of credential, then you can start kind of profiling, you know, the group. So we wanted to make sure that status changes leak as little information as possible, which means that effectively what that means is like, do your index allocation randomly. Use a cryptographically, you know, a cryptographic random number generator. And every time you issue a credential, you pick a totally random place, in there that you issue a credential out of. There are other tactics like use decoy values in here where some of them are not real, randomly flip decoy bits when you flip real bits. There's all kinds of innovation that can happen here that helps preserve privacy. The spec currently just says do it randomly. It doesn't say do all those other things because we didn't feel comfortable giving concrete guidance when this is still kind of an emerging, field, how you do privacy protection correctly, in something like this. But doing random index allocation is pretty good to start with. That's kind of the bare minimum. And then everything else that you do on top of it kind of improves things. Okay. All right. There were a couple of other goals here. You know, we wanted to make sure that it was also fairly easy and straightforward to implement. There are all kinds of like super, advanced zero knowledge proof, mechanisms to do ZKP based like, credential status and things like that. The problem with many of those, solutions is that they haven't had a tremendous amount of analysis done on them by like the National Institute of Standards or the European the ETSI, which is the NIST equivalent in the European Union. When these things are deployed and they're deployed at scale and they're deployed for doing things like foundational identity, driver's licenses, citizenship cards, employment authorization documents, things like that, it is it is nearly impossible to convince, NIST to use something as a central thing that you depend on that hasn't been vetted by them before. And so we needed to, one of the constraints we had is we needed to design something where we didn't have to prove that the cryptography or the math was new or novel or anything like that, right? We had to use boring old stuff that had been around since like the 60s and 70s, to make sure that we would be able to use this in, cutting edge use cases as well as state government, federal government, throughout the world. So that was kind of another design goal here is one, make implementations, fairly easy and straightforward. And then also don't use super fancy new cryptography that would never be accepted by, a nation state or a state government, because those are the entities that are issuing some of these high value digital credentials. Okay. Should have put a slide on that, but I did not. Okay. How it works. Any questions on kind of the goals here before I move on? Like, you know, these are kind of the, like the privacy goals, implementation goals we had. Can anyone think of something that I didn't mention here or other things you're wondering about whether or not we thought about? All right. If not, I'll keep going. How it works. Okay. So this is how it works from an issuance perspective. And it's super simple. It's like really, really straightforward, right? Fundamentally, you've got a verifiable credential on the left, and this is like a degree, like an example degree credential. It's a Bachelor of Science and Arts, and it's issued. And when it's issued, there is this credential status thing that's added to it. So it's this green, this thing in green, that is the information that goes in the VC that tells you which one of these bits in this bitstring status list this credential is associated with. So when a verifier gets this information, they see like, oh, it's got a credential status, and oh, it's a revocation list. So in the position in the list is 94,567, right? And here's the link, here's the URL to the list, down at the bottom, status list credential. And so the verifier has all the information that they need to pull that information, to get the status list and understand which bit is associated with this credential and the purpose of that bit. And that's it. That's the only extra information that's added to a verifiable credential, to say what its association, you know, where its revocation list is. So that's on the left. On the right here, this big green, you know, set of boxes here, that's the array of, that's the bit string status list. It is literally a list of bits. The lowest bit, you know, is on the left and the highest bit is on the right. And this says 16 kilobytes, which is about 131,000 entries. You know, you can just wave your hands and say it's like it's over 100,000 entries, right? This thing uncompressed is 16 kilobytes in size, which is tiny. That's like super tiny. Like all of us, you know, watch video online. That is like a millisecond of whatever show or movie you're watching, right? So these are super tiny, in size, and we can compress them, using what's called zlib compression. This is a type of compression that's been around, I don't know, in the late 70s, early 80s. It's been around for a really long time. Basically takes bits that are the same, like see all these green values, and it compresses them down into like a super small value. So if you have a run of like, let's say you have a run of like 1,000 bits and they're all zero, what the compression will do is say it would use like a very tiny number, like just a byte or two, to say the next 1,000 bits are all zero, right? And that effectively will compress this down. You know, if you only have a handful of credentials that are revoked, that'll compress the list way down from 16 kilobytes to 16,000 bytes down to like 135 bytes. So these things are super space efficient. If most of the credentials haven't been revoked, or if like most of the credentials have been revoked, they're very space efficient. Where they're not space efficient is when you have like a total mixture of revoked and unrevoked things that don't have, you know, long runs of zeros or ones in the list. And at that point, you know, the compression algorithm's like, I can't help you. Like it's, you know, you end up, in that case, random noise is the worst thing to compress. You end up with like around, 16 kilobytes in size, sometimes a bit more if it's truly random noise. But all that to say, like, if our goal here is like group privacy of 100,000 individuals, we can get that in the worst case with 16 kilobytes or in the best case with like 135 bytes. So super tiny, very space efficient. And if we do, you know, random, you know, allocation, that's even better. So we meet, you know, our size, requirements and our privacy requirements, using this mechanism. Okay. So that's it. Like that's how issuance works. The issuer is like, I'm going to put a credential status on this thing for revocation. I'm going to use this bit to specify the revocation index for this verifiable credential. And then that's it. And it creates that. The issuer will sign the thing on the left. It'll do a digital signature on the thing on the left, and it'll do a digital signature on the thing on the right, which looks just like a verifiable credential. Okay, so that's issuance. Let me pause there for a half second, see if there are any questions on issuance. Okay, no questions. Hopefully that means it's pretty clear. Next thing is verification. How does verification work? Right. So this verifiable credential is given to the holder. This is an individual that puts it in like their digital wallet. They go and they want to use it somewhere. So let's say, you know, they're getting a job and they want to prove that they have a bachelor's degree, from a particular, university. And that bachelor's degree has a credential status field because maybe, you know, the university wants to be able to revoke the credential in the very slim chance that they misissued it or it's found later that the individual didn't meet all the requirements for graduation. Okay, so verification, the holder's got their degree. They go to, let's say, a job site. And they hand the verifiable credential that says that they have graduated from a certain university over to the HR department. The HR department would then look at the credential, see that it has a credential status. So it would first check the signature on the credential. Like, is this a valid credential that was issued by this university or not? That check should come back as verified. Yes, this is a valid credential. The digital signature checks out. It hasn't been tampered with. Then the verifier would start validating and would look at like, oh, there's a revocation list here. I should probably check the revocation list to make sure that the university hasn't revoked the credential since they first issued it. And then the verifier basically looks at this field here on the left, this credential status field. And they go like, okay, I need to get this from somewhere. The status list credential is at this URL. So status 3, this URL here. And then once I get that status list, I'm going to expand the bit string and I'm looking for location 94,567 in that list. Dimitri, you're in the queue.
Thanks. So thank you, first of all, for the presentation. I'm a big fan of the revocation list in general. We're implementing it over at DCC for our issuer and verifiers. My question is on the cache control, right? Mm. Have we, as a community, given it some thought? Can we allow the issuer to give some hint, possibly inside the status credential itself, the intended cache, right? So I'm the issuer. I'm saying, you know what? I'm not going to revoke more frequently than once a day. Mm-hmm. So verifiers, you can cache this for a day. So yes, HTTP has cache control headers, but for those of us hosting it, either statically on a website or on something like GitHub Pages, by the way, don't host it on GitHub Pages because GitHub has rate limited. So learn from our mistakes. But for those of us who don't have direct control over the HTTP response headers, could we add a cache control field to the status credential itself?
Excellent question, Dimitri. Yeah, this has certainly come up a bit. I see Bob and Dave are on the queue. So let's, I think Dave's got some, deep thoughts on this. But yeah, it's an excellent question, Dimitri. Go ahead, Bob, and then Dave.
Yeah, I'm sorry if this is a silly question, not well thought out, but if the recommended list size is like on the order of 100K or so, does that mean that it would make sense for a low volume issuer to go to a third party, list maintainer so that low volume of bits would get buried in a higher volume of other bits?
You could do that. So just to respond really quickly, you could do that. It's a little more complicated. There would have to be some kind of agreement between those two organizations. And my expectation is that low volume issuer would just publish the list themselves because it's, you know, let's say they're only issuing like 50 credentials or 100 credentials. It doesn't really matter if the list is 100,000 long, it'll compress down to like 200 bytes, right? And so it's not a huge...
For the privacy concerns.
Even for the privacy concerns, it's kind of like, you know, it doesn't impact them. They're issuing 50 credentials. But their list is 100,000 long, and so anyone looking at the list wouldn't be able to know that that's all they're ever going to issue. Does that make sense?
Hmm. Okay, so you're saying BitString as a service is not a big requirement. Okay, I need to think about that.
Yeah, it's not a requirement. It can be done, but it's not, you know, we wanted something that's easy to deploy. And so if you have to like depend on some other external entity to deploy this thing, that was probably not going to be a good approach. You can do it. It's always optional. You can always layer it on. But, I'm suggesting that the organizational coordination that needs to happen, might not be worth it. But that also doesn't mean that, you know, BitString as a service, you know, can't also happen. There's nothing preventing that from happening. So you can do it either way. I'm saying, and I think the, you know, status list as a service is still a bit of a, you know, we'll see if it ends up, you know, happening or not. Did that help, Bob?
Yeah, I think I need to think about this some more.
Okay. And then Dave, I think you were on the queue to respond to Dimitri's question.
Yeah, I was. So VCs come with a validity period built into them, using the valid until and valid from fields. And what we've found, there's currently a field called time to live TTL that is in the specification. We're not sure if people will implement using it. And that was sort of an attempt to put caching into the credential itself. But we found that might create some conflict, and some false expectations with an issuer. So we were a little worried that, if, you know, this is specifically for cases where you don't have control over HTTP cache headers, as you said, Dimitri. We were a little bit worried with using time to live, in credentials because an issuer might decide to mark a credential as having a very long validity period, but put a short time to live in it. And that might create a false expectation that some verifier will make sure to actually check the time to live and not the validity period only on the credential. On top of that, because these credentials can be fetched by the holder and then transferred later to the verifier, there's no information that's signed about when the holder fetched it. So the holder could always say, no, I got it within the time to live. Don't worry about that. And so we think putting that sort of caching information leads to a number of problems. And we actually think that the use case that you're talking about where you want to have an issuer put these credentials out and have a validity period of about a day can already be solved by just using valid from and valid until. In fact, what they can do is publish these credentials on demand or as status changes with a validity period of about 24 hours. And then let people just do their own caching on that basis, even if they don't have access to changing HTTP cache headers. By having that medium length validity period and doing publishing on demand, I think you can accomplish the use case that you're talking about.
Go ahead, Dimitri.
Understood. Thank you. So three thoughts. Well, one is I can totally see the potential confusion where the validity period is a month, but the time to live is a day. And the verifier also doesn't know when that time to live started from. You're right. Renaming the field to cache control might be slightly easier, but again, verifier doesn't know when that period started. It makes sense that we can use shorter lived credentials so that valid from valid until becomes the cache control. That makes sense. I would caution against the, issuing them on demand because that just kicks the phone home problem over one level, right? The on-demand part gives issuer more information that we may want to provide, but makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's an excellent question, Dimitri. I mean, I it sounds to me like, you know, currently we're basically saying just depend on the valid from, valid until for the status list credential. Like that is your, you know, that is a cache control that you can depend on. And then if you do have control over the HTTP headers, set the headers to the same time frame, so that if people are using HTTP caching, headers, you know, it's aligned with the values in the status list. The other thing also to keep in mind is remember we wanted to enable the holder to be able to deliver the status list credential themselves. And so if you have like a month long validity period for the status list, if a verifier gets that, like, and it's a month long status list, they're going to almost certainly go out to the verifier and try to get the latest one. Cause they're going to look at it and they're going to go, a month's too long. I can't be sure. You know, I want information as of today. They go and they fetch the thing and it turns out it's the same list, right? So maybe, you know, the right solution here is to have daily or weekly status list credential, signatures and your validity dates, you know, have stick to that range. And that addresses, I believe, all of the use cases we've found. Go ahead, Dimitri. I think you were on the queue there for a
Thanks.
Little bit.
Thanks. I guess my other question, and I think a lot of us on the call might be interested in that, is so what's next in terms of other revocation specs? What are the design challenges that we're exploring? What has there been demand for, et cetera?
Yeah, excellent question. So I've got a slide at the end where I'll get to that. So let me get through the verification. I think that's the very next slide or two down. Okay, so just to cover what verification, you know, the verifier gets the credential, they get the status list, they check the bit. If it's, you know, if it's a revocation status list, if the bit's one, it's revoked. If it's zero, it's not revoked, right? So again, pretty straightforward. Okay, so this is kind of leading up to Dimitri's question. Did we actually address our requirements? You know, because of the design and the way it works, the issuer doesn't get to see which individual status is being checked. Individual privacy is preserved as long as the issuer is not a bad actor. I'll get into what being a bad actor means later. The observers list, so if there's somebody watching the status list change over time, we use randomness and dummy values. And so because we do that, you know, group privacy continues to be preserved. Again, as long as the issuer isn't a bad actor and is trying to like signal things to the outside world by bunching a bunch of issuance you know, to a certain part of the list. From a storage perspective, storage efficiency is achieved because you can't get, you know, much smaller than a single bit, of storage, for this, status list. And then one of the most important things is this ability to deliver the status list for the holder to be able to deliver the status list instead of the verifier needing to go and get it directly from the issuer. Now, this asterisk here is, you know, we say as long as the issuer is not a bad actor, because if the issuer is a bad actor, they can do something, they can do things to violate the individual's privacy. For example, using one status list for every single VC that they issue. Then when the verifier comes to check the list, there's a one-to-one mapping between the list and the issued credential. So if the issuer is a bad actor, you really can't do much. You know, they have to be bought into the privacy preserving characteristics and employ them. Now, you can observe issuers cheating in this way as long as you get a decent number of holders together. You get, like, for example, you get 1,000 holders together, and those 1,000 holders are like, we all have different IDs for our status list. That is a signal that the issuer is tracking us, right? And digital wallets can do this kind of analysis, with consent of the individual, of course, to try and protect the individual, to basically warn the individual, like, hey, your electrician's license has a tracking cookie in it. You may not want to use this, or every time you use this, you know, the issuer is going to know you're using this. So those kinds of things can, you know, be done to catch bad actors. Go ahead, Harrison.
Yeah, so just to clarify, does the verifier get the status list from the issuer? Or because on this bullet point, you also mentioned it can be, the verifiers can get the status list from the holder. So I'm just trying to clarify, is it from the issuers or from
either
the holders
possible.
Or both?
Yeah, okay. Both. Either is possible. What we don't know yet is if the digital wallets are going to build in the support for delivering the status list themselves. And counting on that happening was something that we couldn't do because we couldn't get a straight answer from the wallet providers, because the wallet providers were like, well, yeah, sure. Like, if other wallets do it, maybe we'll do it too. And it's like, okay, well, we can't really build a global standard on, you know, people waiting around to see what would happen. So we wanted to build it in a way where it was guaranteed you'd be able to get the list, but there's a step up from a privacy perspective that wallets could do. If we could convince the wallet vendors to do that kind of delivery. And the verifiers also have to support it. Like, it's a more complex protocol where the verifier accepts a status list, not from the original issuer themselves. But yeah, both approaches are possible. Go ahead, Dimitri.
Yeah, I wanted to add that it seems that getting the status list from remote is preferable because getting the status list credential from the presenter in parallel with the original VC requires a pretty advanced known issuer infrastructure, or else requires that the issuer signs the status VC with the same keys or the same DID as the original VC of which it's the status for, right? Like, the correlation, how do I know that these two DID keys belong to, you know, the same university or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. And for that, yes, that's an excellent point, Dimitri. Our expectation is that whoever issues the VC is going to use the exact same key material to issue the, status list. But you're right. That might not always be true. And you know, it's like, who knows what's going to happen when this stuff is deployed at scale? It may be that there's like a large actor that does do exactly what you said, which is, you know, use two totally different DID keys to sign two totally different things. And then you have to have a trust list and so on and so forth. So, we're putting options, on the table. Oh, Dimitri's saying they do that already. Right. So what we're doing is we're putting options on the table, that we don't think are dangerous, from a privacy perspective. And then we're going to see what we can nudge the ecosystem towards. But this last slide gets into Dimitri's, you know, question, which is, could we do better? And the answer, the short answer is yes, of course we can do better, right? There are these other zero knowledge proof based schemes that allow you to do unlinkable revocation based on ZKPs. Anoncreds V2 has done some really good work in this area. They're looking at something called Alisor, which we could use as a different credential status mechanism. The key point here is that the verifiable credential 2.0 data model is designed to be extensible, right? We are starting off with this because we think it does some good things from a privacy perspective. But we know that this is not the end solution. Like, we are going to want to move to these other things, as long as they are proven to be secure, as long as, you know, nation states and state governments are willing to use them. Like, there are a number of things that have to happen in the space for us to move to a different solution. But the good news here is that, like, we have the architecture to move to the next thing without it being super disruptive on what we deploy today. So that's kind of it. And I note that we're very much at the end of our time here. So back over to you, Harrison.
Thank you, Manu. Thanks a lot. Any last questions for Manu? Great. Thanks for a great presentation and a great discussion. I think this concludes this week's CCG meeting. Thanks a lot.